it's an example of how big data is intersecting with the study of social interactions. Is that fair to say?
Yes, and that's one of our main areas of developing science in studying cities is how can we use big data to better understand how people are functioning in cities.
You wrote and just published, you've published a number of really interesting articles, but the article that you just published with some people on called The Long View of Polluting Industry and Environmental Justice in Baltimore had some really interesting and frankly surprising findings. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Sure. In that work, what we were trying to understand was what has been, in the case of Baltimore, the history of environmental justice. And the normal assumption is that African Americans are more likely to live near polluted areas than that in the general frame of environmental justice research. What we find in Baltimore actually is the reverse, that low-income white neighborhoods are more likely to be near polluting industry than African American neighborhoods. And the reason for this, it turns out, is that because of the history of segregation that existed in the city of Baltimore, that people, there was preference given to workers to live close to work and to industrial work. And so what happened was it was those white manufacturing industry jobs in those white neighborhoods that were located right next to them because they were given preference for where they could live. And African Americans had to commute longer to get to work. It turns out that those living close to those industries, while it may have been convenient in terms of getting to work, had severe health consequences. And it's sort of an unlikely finding that we have for Baltimore.
It's a really there's some really interesting findings in that study.
Yeah.
You know, that study is really more about, in some ways, when I read it, it's more of a, it's sort of about the changes in where people live and the long-term implications of segregation in a way.
Yes.
And so maybe what you could say is the study produced a very ironic outcome that of the legacy of segregation, right?
Sure,
because
sure.
It really is true. You know?
It is, and
so why don't
I mean,
we?
The thing that I've always wanted to write, you know, is segregation is bad for whites, as you know, from an environmental justice perspective.
Say that, right? Say, you know, so Morgan, you just published a very interesting article on pollution and environmental justice that had some surprising findings that maybe I would characterize as what goes around comes around. And maybe talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, we have been doing a lot of research trying to understand the long-term history of environmental justice. And to really summarize it in a bullet point would be that segregation is bad for whites. What we observed historically is that whites were more likely to live through segregation, were more likely to live next to polluting areas. What we see now is in the context of climate change and sea level rise is where whites are preferentially living now, they're going to be most exposed to the changes in climate change as well.
And is that because whites were trying to live near where they worked when there were a lot of industrial plants around?
That's exactly right. And it's only by understanding that long-term history do we understand what we observe today.
Maybe you could talk a little bit about the exposure and the air pollution that we have in Baltimore, because some of the statistics that you come up with about exposure to air pollution are really quite extraordinary. I think it's people are four times as likely to be exposed to toxic pollutants in certain areas than others.
That's right. So we see the spatial differences that exist in the city, and they have social consequences. We don't know exactly how that will be obvious in terms of the health consequences, but certainly the exposure that we get from the EPA data is indicating that the local pollution is much higher for some groups than others.
So Let's talk about the assertion that more trees equals better life. And I think you've actually proved that assertion in many ways, both with respect to the quality of life and crime.
Mm-hmm. So we've been doing a lot of research on the issue of the relationship between trees and crime. And it ends up being kind of running against an urban myth because people feel as though where there's more trees, there's more crime. What we're able to show is that actually it's the opposite. And the basic numbers are for every 10%, if you have 10% more trees in your neighborhood than other areas, crime goes down 11%. And the reason for that is, as you examine it, becomes understandable. One of which is that if you have more people out on the street, then criminals feel unsafe. And it's kind of a strange way to think about it. You want to make criminals feel unsafe for committing crimes. And they want to commit crimes when no one can see them. So people are out there. It also turns out from interviews of criminals that trees on the street is sort of an indication that the neighborhood's well organized and they're more likely to call. Not only will they see you, but they will make a phone call than areas that don't have trees. And so it works out to be sort of like the sign that says neighborhood watch. Having lots of trees that are well cared for on a street is almost like having a neighborhood watch sign as far as how criminals perceive it.
And you've had enough data to make a statistically significant finding of that fact.
We have, and we're able to show in areas where trees are not well taken care of that you have higher levels of crime. So it's not just a question of how many trees you have, but are they well cared for?
And what about that urban myth that says if you grow fruit trees, you're going to attract more rats?
Yeah, that's not something that I think is really supported. What we really need to have, and I think that we see in Baltimore through the Baltimore Orchards Project, is if that fruit is harvested and any fruit that falls to the ground is picked up, that you don't have a rat problem whatsoever.
So rats would prefer to live under concrete than under fruit trees?
Yes, and that's something else that's recently been found. And actually, the first studies ever in North America on rats began in Baltimore at Hopkins and the School of Public Health. What we find is that rats prefer to live under impervious surfaces, under paved areas, than in gardens or under fruit trees. And so when people say, hey, let's pave that and get rid of the rats, they're actually doing the opposite. They're making more space for rats to live.
That's a remarkable finding.
Thank you.
So if you look at your big data and the tree cover in Baltimore, what does it tell you?
Well, it's actually a little bit surprising. The idea has always been that maybe population density is the best predictor of where we have trees, or maybe it's a question of wealthier neighborhoods having more trees. What we're finding is actually that we can understand Baltimore as we can understand any city in terms of markets. Just like the market analysis that's used to figure out where to put a Starbucks, the same kinds of ways of thinking can be used to understand where we have trees. And it turns out that where we have trees, based upon people's, yes, income and education, but also their life stage, is a very good predictor about where we have trees. And I'll give you an example. So my father and I, he has a little bit less education and a little bit more income. And we won't chase after that relationship. But my father wants to have as little lawn to mow as possible. I have two kids. I manage my yard for wiffle ball. And so understanding where we are in our life stage with kids actually ends up being a really good predictor about where we have trees and what our motivations are for how we take care of our individual properties.
So I think one thing that people don't fully understand is that in Leakin Park, we've got one of the largest tracts of municipal forest, municipal parkland in the United States. Is that fair to say?
That is true. We have what we call one of the largest wilderness forested areas, urban wilderness forested areas in the United States. We're second to the wilderness forested area in Portland, Oregon.
That's remarkable. So we have more wilderness forest area in the city of Baltimore than any other city except for Portland.
That's pretty much true, yes.
That blows my mind. That statistic always just... So what is the biggest impediment to increasing the tree cover in the city of Baltimore?
Well, I think that we one is to some extent it. Let me start over. The one could argue that it's financial, and that we need more of a municipal budget for planting street trees. Certainly, that is the case. We need more money for planting trees on for street trees. But the street trees are actually a very small percentage of the amount of forest that we have in the city. The major amount of forest that we do have in the city is on private residential homes, associated with private residential homes. The area where we have the most space for planting trees is private residential homes. And we need to work better at understanding why people want to plant trees, why don't they want trees, what are the obstacles for planting trees, and to really that kind of market analysis, you know, basically it's business market analysis, that's our biggest gap that we have. I don't think that's necessarily a money thing of do we have enough money for planting trees. I think that we need to understand residential landowners better and why they do or they don't want trees. We also have to help them understand that what they do is really important for the overall health, in human health and the environmental health of the city.
Is it a good use of public land in a city with a population that's declined? There is a large number of properties that are owned by the city. Is it a good use and a good public policy to plant some of those with trees, let them go as a place we're going to build houses and build apartments and simply plant them with forests for the long run?
Well, there's this term that's called land banking. And it is quite reasonable to think that these areas that are currently vacant, that we might land bank them and plant trees. There are a couple benefits for doing it, one of which is that it signals that this neighborhood, actually, if these trees grow well, that it becomes a pull where people may want to say, hey, I'd like to live in this neighborhood. We have these trees. The trees there also displace unwanted activities. Mm-hmm. Could be drug dealing, it could be littering, and so on. And then if there's a decision that we have a sufficiently robust economy and people are moving back, you can always take the trees down. What we have is something for the Forest Service, which is in its 100th anniversary. The Forest Service began as a land reclamation agency. We had these areas in Western Maryland that had been clear cut, and communities had been destroyed. The environment had been destroyed, and the Forest Service came in to think about how do we do land reclamation and to bring the forest back and to bring the people back. I think that we have a similar issue in many cities like Baltimore, Detroit, Cleveland, where how do we reclaim the land and bring the environment back and bring the people back to some of these neighborhoods that are really on hard times.